So some people may wonder why we chose to talk about emergence, specifically the emergence of wisdom, in this theme. And I'll share a quote with you by Omid Safi. Our well-being and the world being well are linked together. To tend to our own inner lives is not selfishness, it is wisdom. It is essential for the sake of the world. The protagonist, Sid Arthur, of Hermann Hesse's novel by the same name, confides to his lifelong companion, Govinda, "I'm telling you what I have discovered. Knowledge can be communicated, but not wisdom. One can find it, live it, be fortified by it, do wonders with it, but one cannot communicate and teach it." And despite that ominous constraint, our topic today is the emergence of wisdom and how to support and nurture it in our modern lives. The quote I'm fond of by David Starr Jordan, and which I use as my signature on all the email I send, is, "If wisdom is knowing what to do next, then virtue consists in doing it." Which admits to some doubt as to the definition of wisdom, but if we admit to wisdom being a personal attribute conditioned by the exigencies of a particular life in a particular culture, in a particular historical period, then linking wisdom to virtue, I take to be a good thing. Nothing we do or have can be thrown away. We say away, and we think we know what we mean. But a landfill is not away. It's a place, maybe near somebody's backyard. When we're being unfriendly, unwilling to listen, or willing to rush to judgment, our heart will not let us wipe it away or forget the shame of it. Kindness and abuse return like emotional echoes, as if we lived in a room full of drums. Like a boat on the ocean, our lives leave a wake of joys and sorrows, and that wake will find a shore, and usually it is somewhere nearby. Even when we do nothing but turn away, refuse to call for help, or ignore the racism in the national discourse, that also echoes in our hearts. All of this creates the possibility for wisdom to emerge in each of us. Wisdom is not just an intellectual knowing, it is also a felt power. Wisdom notices that when we do this, we don't get what we're hoping for. And when we do that, we do get the outcome we wanted. And over time, we distill from that kind of noticing some specific strategies to help us deal with our unwieldy world and our changeable hearts. But wisdom only alights on those who see themselves and their own world clearly. The ancient Greeks' exhortation, "Know thyself," is perhaps the best and most succinct advice ever given. I sent away for the Know Thyself user's guide online, but it hasn't showed up yet. Might be just as well, since I'm out of drachmas, and I suspect it would all be Greek to me. I believe it was Mark Twain who observed that a cat who leaps to sit on a hot stove will never attempt to do that again, even when the stove is cold. So clarity about what is causal is an essential aspect of wisdom. The unwise cat is prejudiced about stoves when it's really heat that matters. Denial and distortions of our experience and feelings can't lead to wisdom. It requires high fidelity recording, no matter how embarrassing the truth is. I won't tell you that I hid behind the sofa while watching the movie Frankenstein when I was in fourth grade, but I know it's true. The suspension of moral judgment is key to the practice of insight meditation. It helps us see clearly when dealing with memories of shame and self-image. As for emergence, is it an artifact of time or an artifact of attention? I believe we temporize the world because we can't handle seeing everything at once. Once again, in Siddhartha, the protagonist asks the ferryman this question: have you learned the secret from the river that there is no such thing as time, that the river is everywhere at the same time, at the source and at the mouth, at the waterfall, at the ferry, everywhere, and that the present only exists for it, not the shadow of the past or future? Our lives are like the moving river. Because we have memory, we conceive time as different places on the river, and those upstream are the past, and those downstream are the future. But the process of the river from enough distance is completely in the present. Meditators everywhere are enjoined to do their best to stay in the present moment, as the future is just a collapsing cloud of possibilities, and the past is a fractured fog of half-remembered moments. The present is a gift that should be open constantly, which has the benefit of keeping you from worrying about what the future will bring or living in the mythic, idealized fog of the past. As for noticing, I refer you to the old saw about the tree that falls in the forest and the question about whether or not it makes a sound if no one's there to hear it. The frog that is sitting in the proverbial pot will eventually be cooked, unable as it is to notice the change. This is how emergence becomes emergency. Emergence is not a bold and discreet act. It is likely to be subtle and gradual, like the return of leaves in the spring. It is our task to try to notice the distant shifting of the way important tasks are accomplished and investigate changes and predict and resist negative outcomes. Maybe we are led to an idea for a new way to grow, to be in the world, an adventure without a clear map or destination. Innovation takes with it the best of what it's leaving and a desire to ditch what is not useful, to reshape life in a friendlier fashion. But the way forward is not always clear, nor the mechanism well understood, or the outcome without its own shortcomings. The path forward is full of toll booths and traditions that demand homage. We may not understand why we chose the path we're on, but no matter how creative we are, we find ourselves using some of the well-worn paths and highways simply because they are there. But the emergent wisdom is that profit supersedes caution and public safety. The poor mostly suffer under the arrogance of greed that abuses the natural world, while issues of social justice, disease, and toxicity are whitewashed by marketing and the blurring of the lines between industry and regulators. by governmental dysfunction and inaction, and by the empowerment of the rich to share even less and control even more. Our democracy seems now ill-suited to ride the bull of capitalism. But will the pendulum swing again as it has before? Can we overcome voter suppression, gerrymandering, and Citizens United? To those who study history, the boom-bust cycle is well understood. But are we hapless boats floating on the troubled seas of events? Or are we the resistance that returns the gyrating cycle to peace and justice? Was FDR's observation, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself," right? Is the promised brave new world turning out to be a hollow and slow-moving emergency, where the limits of growth and the fragility of the environment are leading to a global crisis? Decreasing biodiversity, marginalizing the elderly and the weak, and filling the streets with homeless and troubled souls, who in more earth-centered cultures would be esteemed as wise elders. That's a damning picture of the current social situation, but this is where things get interesting. You may be thinking things couldn't be worse, but consider what it's like to be an undocumented immigrant or a dreamer in today's USA. Or what if you've already been deported? Where is your home? Or you're living in the Middle East and there's a war going on in your backyard for decades. Iraq 1, Iraq 2, Afghanistan ongoing, ISIS, Lebanon, Syria, the Congo. Your children are dodging bullets and bombs. Your daughters are not allowed to go to school. Or what if you're an Afro-American with a cell phone in your hand in your own backyard? When I take a dispassionate look at the history that I have lived through, it seems to me that the world has always been at war, someplace or other. My Uncle Leo was a paraplegic because he was shot during the Allied invasion of France shortly after surviving Omaha Beach. Uncle Franny served in the Pacific during World War II and would never talk about what happened there. I remember playing war as a youngster, and the bad guys were the Nazis while the Korean War was being fought. Then there was the ever-present threat of nuclear war from the boogeyman of all boogeymen, the H-bomb. And then the Vietnam police action and the failed invasion of Cuba, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The point being that today is not much different than it has always been. Maybe a little better even, because of all the resistance that people are putting out. The Red States teachers' strikes come to mind, as well as the Parkland, Florida students that are standing up to the NRA. Black Lives Matters, Standing Rock, the Women's Resistance March, and so many others. One striking difference today is the information overload. We evolved in tribes as a species, and we only had to deal with what was happening in our immediate surroundings. We need to filter the information to a level that we can deal with. Smartphones are like carrying every network in your pocket. Vietnam was confined to the evening news for me and occasional protests and articles. The world is too much with us. Pick your causes and your battles, but do it from a place of relaxed caring for those who need assistance and those who are creating the pressure. Meditation I have found to be a powerful way to relax and release my creative energy and compassion for both victims and oppressors. As Thich Nhat Hanh has observed, speak the truth, but never to punish. Speak the truth, but never to punish. I have also found that having a community of like-minded people who value creative energy a great help in maintaining equanimity and a sense of having a spiritual home. We are truly lucky to have each other, because in the final analysis, the reason why we resist for people we have never met is because we realize we are one species. If we lose sight of our unity, then the forces of hatred have won. Let me share with you my poem, One Water, One World, on that topic. Waking up sometimes, a feeling of strangeness settles on me, like a fog, or more like the clarity of a mystery. Here is this moment, right before me, in the openness of a mountain stream, hiding nothing. The rocky bottom vivid, the surface bent and disturbed in a slippery way by the squeezing and rushing, and yet I am an obstacle to it, a mystery to me. For I have a past that I recall. The water has passed by here for a long time, judging from the rounded rocks. Still, does the water now remember the water then? It did find its way here still, this gathering of raindrops, this gully of cloud dust. Perhaps it is a mistake to guess the water feels separate, as I do feel in this moment, but not completely. Maybe the water, the world around, is one water, everywhere aware of all other water, whether drifting on Arctic ice, its solid cousins, staunch and stable, tolerate their liquid kin, or cascading over Niagara Falls, or swelling my bladder. I'm familiar with the objects, but a mortal why hangs on my every thought, as if everything is imbued with a reason that they are sworn not to disclose. Beautiful as they may be or common, they amuse themselves by playing keep away with me as they toss their reasons out of my reach to each other. Why now? Why me? Why here in the immense river of time do I get a pass to live out my days in this epoch, this leading edge, at least for now, of humans in history and herstory? This musing in time has an inkling of eternity about it, as if these moments became unglued from the rush forward. And so, like the river, time is bent and disturbed in a slippery way. It's sort of like how it feels to have reached the summit of a mountain. The land in every direction is revealed in a way that is novel and confers both an isolation and a connection upon that summit, as if it were the hub of a vast wheel. Before the rush of all the practicalities and necessities of living, push this moment aside and claim their right to my attention, as I know they will and must. Here, at this summit moment, I sway between the sense of familiar and strangeness to be alive now and not thousands of years ago, hunting for food, sleeping under the stars, and having no understanding of what a star is, besides a point of light in a trackless darkness. Nor to be alive hence thousands of years, if, as a species, we're as smart as we think we are, to stand in a mountain stream and think how strange to be there then. Perhaps It is a mistake to guess that people feel separate as I do in this moment, but not completely. Maybe people, the world around, are one people, everywhere and every when, aware of all other people, whether being born or dying. Hugging in joy, crying in tragedy or heartbreak. Maybe that's the reason being alive feels so strange, like the clarity of a mystery or a fog that settles on the mountain, hiding everything else to help you understand that water is one water, people, one people, this world, one world, for all to savor and save.